I next met with Dr. Robert Dreiser. To begin, we chatted about new strategies in optimizing the oldest form of systemic treatment of prostate cancer, hormonal manipulation, and the newest approved means of systemic treatment of the disease, abiraterone.
The whole concept of androgen biosynthesis inhibition sprinkled around abiraterone is probably not as well appreciated as it should be. You know, for years we've been, in a sense, treating around the edges of the disease. The development of chemotherapy was a nice advance, but the reality was we all know that this is an androgen receptor-driven disease. And for a long period of time, we sort of almost hallucinated management. So we decided that we needed to maintain castrate levels of testosterone, which we sort of arbitrarily defined as less than 50 nanograms per DL, and said that we need to have that persist even when the patients became, using old terminology, androgen-independent, hormone-refractory, because we thought it was a reasonable thing to do. But we really didn't have any data to support it. So what's been very clear, especially with the publication of the abiraterone phase 3 trial in the post-chemotherapy setting, is now we have unequivocal evidence that maintenance of what we not only used to think of as castrate levels, but probably much lower than that, is absolutely critical to disease management, because now we're finally again targeting the androgen receptor.
So agree or disagree, when in the past we've talked about being castrate resistant, but maybe in some people's mind that was the same as endocrine resistant, and we're now knowing that those are two completely different things.
Yeah, the concepts of hormone refractory or androgen independent are misnomers, and actually even when we were using them, we kind of knew they were misnomers, right? So perfect example, you have a patient you're managing who's progressed on LHRH agonist therapy, and somebody decides to use a secondary hormonal manipulation, bicalutamide or ketoconazole. And 20% of patients responded. Well, how could they respond if they were refractory? So they weren't truly refractory. So at this juncture, castrate resistance simply means that we have a patient where their serum testosterone levels are at a certain level and they have progressive disease.
And I guess, you know, you agree or disagree, this is a very familiar concept to medical oncologists because it's very similar to the breast cancer model conceptually.
It becomes even more consistent as we get more data in prostate cancer, sort of beginning to catch up to the breast cancer oncology folks.
Well, one thing we always knew about breast cancer, and I think it's true of prostate cancer, is that even if these patients clinically develop disease progression, they still had, you know, estrogen or androgen receptors in their tumor.
Right. And that's exactly right. Now the difference is, after many decades of really having the basic and translational science in breast cancer, we now actually have it in prostate cancer.
So just to maybe draw that analogy out even a little bit more, it's always been a little mysterious to me anyhow, and listening to people in terms of what the mechanisms of resistance are in breast cancer. They've talked about other pathways, you know, kind of going around the estrogen receptor. What about in prostate cancer?
I think we're going to find that there are lots of similarities. So we know that, for example, if you use abiraterone, so you drop somebody's serum testosterone to less than one, at some point in time, disease progression occurs. So what's going on? Well, it's androgen signaling, and signaling may come from increased numbers of receptors, different pathways. Some even suggest that there may be truly androgen-independent pathways of progression. So I think there are going to be similarities to breast cancer in that there'll be multiple pathways for progression.
So in terms of this, I think everybody now has probably heard a little bit, at least a little bit about abiraterone, but there are also other agents out there that are not yet available. I know one's TAC 700. I think there are others. What exactly are these various agents actually doing, and how do they differ?
So let's just start with the abiraterone and TAC 700 question. These are two, in a sense, sort of cousins. They're androgen biosynthesis inhibitors. They're chemically different. I mean, one of the things that people ask not infrequently about Abby is because of the potential for mineralic corticoid excess, you have to use some glucocorticoids. Johann de Bona has written about this a lot. Using abiraterone, perhaps 20% of patients could be managed without any glucocorticoid repletement. TAC 700 is a different molecule, so probably a higher percentage of patients could be managed because it's a little bit more selective in terms of the enzyme pathway. So they're going to be some biochemical differences between these molecules, but the androgen biosynthesis inhibitors are probably, in the big scheme of things, cousins. It's the other class of agents, the MDV3100, the second generation anti-androgens, which are mechanistically very different drugs, which may make them both compounds that can be used in combination or in sequence, but target totally different pathways, but both AR targeting.
So maybe you can hone in a little bit more on what the second generation antiandrogens do. But first, before we get off, these are lyase inhibitors, is that correct?
Yeah, they're two different enzymes that are part of the cholesterol pathway down to testosterone and ultimately dihydrotestosterone that convert the enzymes over. And these are blocking some of those key enzymes. Similar to the enzymes that are involved, actually they're identical enzymes that ketoconazole was used to target. You can think of ketoconazole as a poor man's abiraterone.
So, you know, one of the things that I wonder about is, again, I don't know, I can't help but thinking again about endocrine therapy of breast cancer. How would you compare what aromatase inhibitors do to what these agents do?
I think that the androgen biosynthesis inhibitors are sort of somewhat analogous. I think you can think about it that way. I think that for, say, the bicalutamide first-generation antiandrogens and MDV-3100 second generations, they're somewhat different.
Well, the antiandrogens I always thought about as being like tamoxifen.
That's exactly a reasonable analogy.
But these other agents seem like AIs. And then also, I think about, I remember actually the original AI aminoglutethamide in breast cancer, you had to use corticosteroids with, and then the modern agents you don't. Again, is that kind of where things are heading with prostate cancer?
I think that ultimately, again, just looking at the comparison between a compound like abiraterone and then TAC 700 or other molecules in that class, I think there's a way to sort of bypass the mineralic corticoid excess. So at some point in time, we will be using this class of compounds without so much concerns about glucocorticoid repletement.
So what about these new antiandrogens? I always was fascinated by bicalutamide. You know, I was kind of wondering why somehow along the way, the last 10 years, I don't know, it didn't get used more. It wasn't more successful. I thought it was a pretty cool drug. But anyhow, now we're beyond that.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that, assuming MDV-3100 meets its study endpoints and ultimately works through its regulatory process, which we certainly hope will happen, it's likely that the bicalutamides of the world, at least in terms of their use as secondary hormonal therapies. So remember, many of us either use combined androgen blockade initially or monotherapy with a short course of a drug like bicalutamide to sort of block a testosterone flare. I think because of the fact that it's a generic compound, in that clinical setting, it's a very reasonable thing to use. But in the context of more advanced disease, for example, when patients progress on LHRH agonist therapy and perhaps an abiraterone compound, assuming it gets moved up earlier, MDV-3100 is going to be a compound that we would use as a secondary hormonal maneuver.
And again, kind of like tamoxifen, this binds the androgen receptor, you know, competitively, not competitively?
Competitively, but to a much higher degree than first generation.
And clinically, then, meaningful responses have been seen with these kinds of agents after they've been treated with previous hormone therapies?
The data that we have in the public domain from MDV-3100 was primarily a compilation of phase 1-2 trials published in the JCO, about 100 patients. When one looks at that data in the context, these are some pre-chemotherapy, some post-chemotherapy patients, I think that we see clinical responses, meaning soft tissue responses, certainly very significant PSA responses. I think many of us believe that this is a real compound and are anxiously awaiting the randomized trial results to sort of validate that.
It seems a little bit early in terms of the number of patients you just mentioned. What about gynecomastia, though?
Not a huge issue. It's not, in a sense, similar to bicalutamide. And in many instances, the gynecomastia that was typically seen with bicalutamide, this is in the context of patients who were really, some of them who were not receiving LHRH agonist therapy or had not undergone bilateral ORC. The MDV-3100 compound will likely be used as a secondary, tertiary maneuver. These patients will have been long at castrate levels of testosterone, so I wouldn't anticipate gynecomastia being an issue.
So let's talk about some cases, beginning with your 65-year-old man who presented 3 years ago.
So this is a gentleman who underwent radical prostatectomy. He had a Gleason 7 tumor. He had two positive nodes found at time of his node dissection. He had an undetectable PSA for a couple of months post-op, and then a slow detectable rise of PSA over the course of a little over a year.
So I know he received endocrine treatment, but had evidence of Mets, but wasn't really symptomatic.
And then a slow rise in PSA. over the course of about 9 months, and now has, again, remaining asymptomatic in terms of disease, but now has biochemical progression in the castrate setting. So we document a serum testosterone. It's 28 nanograms per DL. He feels fine. And the question now is what to do. And, you know, at that point, there are a series of options. But one of the options that we would have discussed and did discuss with this gentleman was Sipuleucel-T.
And just before you get into that, what was his lifestyle like around that time? And how was he spending his time?
He's an active retired gentleman. He has sort of a couple of small side businesses that he runs. I mean, he was maintaining his normal activities. He complained again about weight. And as the summers would hit, the hot flashes would get a little worse. But other than that, he was totally without any impact of his disease.
How about his sexuality / sexual function?
Well, this was a gentleman I remember. Of course, he had no libido as a consequence of his testosterone level. Early on in his hormonal therapy, he inquired about using, you know, compounds to achieve erections, which we told him were reasonable. He could achieve an erection. And he made a couple of attempts, but told me ultimately that he was no longer making those attempts.
And just out of curiosity, I mean, do you see patients, and if so, how often, who actually, you know, can have pretty good sexual or decent sexual function?
A small number. They tend to be somewhat younger patients who, despite the absence of libido, are interested in trying to maintain some type of sex life with their partners.
And incidentally, clinically, is that what you mainly observe? You know, the key thing is the libido?
There's an absence of libido.
Okay, so he's got an active lifestyle, and yet his blood work is deteriorating. What were you thinking?
So, you know, at this point, again, he's asymptomatic, so he fits into a series of possible management strategies. You know, historically, we would have thought about things like secondary hormonal therapies, like ketoconazole or reintroducing bicalutamide. That's not, at this point, something he was terribly excited about. Clinical trials were available to him, not interested in that as well. And as we went through the litany, one of the things we talked about was Sipuleucel-T. And, you know, he had not really heard about that before. And as we talked about the therapy and its implications, he was intrigued enough. And to be honest with you, what he was intrigued mostly about was the fact that it was a therapy that over the course of 4 to 5 weeks, he'd be done with. And it had the potential to make him live longer. He was attracted to a non-toxic potential improvement in his survival, albeit maybe modestly.
I would like you to go through what we know today about this agent, both in terms of how it works, side effects, as well as clinical data. But before you do, just out of curiosity, and a lot of this is always timing, but at this same exact point, what are the other options? And you were talking about abiraterone. It's been looked at after chemo, but would you use it in this situation?
So, as you know, there is a large trial that is not yet reported in this exact setting. Patients who have castrate progressive disease, have not been treated with chemotherapy, randomized to receive or not receive abiraterone. We are anxiously awaiting this data. Your question is, now that abiraterone is FDA approved, would I, could I prescribe it for this gentleman? So the answer is, we certainly could prescribe it. It's off-label, but we could prescribe it. You also know that it's a very expensive compound, and it's very unlikely that any of his carriers would pay for it. And I usually have that discussion with patients to explain to them sort of this gap that we're in between having data to drive an FDA approval, but a drug that we know mechanistically is likely to be appropriate to be used in his clinical setting.
Yeah, I guess to be continued, but I mean, it's one thing to compare abiraterone to Sipuleucel-T, and it's another thing to compare it to docetaxel or cabazitaxel, but as I say, that's a discussion for another time. So what do we know about Sipuleucel-T?
Well, this is one of the great conundrums of sort of modern oncology. We know that this was the first therapeutic vaccine approved by the FDA. We know that based on a more definitive randomized trial, there was an improvement in survival of about 4 months. Mechanistically, doing immunology in humans is a real challenging thing. And this particular trial, for a variety of reasons, really did little, if any, prospective immunologic assessment. And again, it's not as if there were definitive immunologic assessments to do.
Interesting. So what happened with this man?
So he received Sipuleucel-T without complication, and about 4 months later had a progressive biochemical rise. He got imaged, bone scan was still clean, progressive nodal disease, and he opted to go on a phase two clinical trial.
And what about the actual treatment that he received, the Sipuleucel-T? Did he have any side effects, infusion reactions?
He did not. He actually had no problems at all. And the majority of patients really don't have any issues. Occasionally, there's a little bit of a minor sort of flu-like reaction, but the vast majority of patients really tolerate it quite well.
All right. How about if we talk about your 77-year-old man?
So this is a gentleman who presented with metastatic disease, de novo. He walked in the door with bone metastases. He was started on combined androgen blockade.
How long ago was this?
This gentleman must have been about 4 years ago.
And he had not had screening?
No, he walked into his family practice office docs for his once every 7 year visit and felt poorly for the couple of months and had widespread bone metastases, a very large prostate, and the diagnosis was made pretty quickly.
What was his biopsychosocial, you know, sort of background?
This gentleman was an inner city resident, had some nieces and nephews that looked at him periodically, but they didn't really have a real good handle on his clinical status.
And comorbidities?
Some heart disease, diabetes, hypertension. I think that was what he walked around with mostly.
Was he getting treated for any of that?
Intermittently.
So just out of curiosity, of course, you know, this presentation certainly wouldn't have been uncommon, I'm not sure how long ago, 20 years ago?
20 years ago.
How often do you see patients like this nowadays?
You know, at a very large referral center, I would say we see about 40 or 50 guys like this, which is a lot, but compared to hundreds and hundreds years ago.
Interesting. So at that point when he presented, did he have symptoms from the metastatic disease?
Yeah, he had had about a 20-pound weight loss. He was anorectic and he had bone pain.
So what were you thinking in terms of options at that point?
So initially he got hospitalized because his pain was severe. He got started immediately on ketoconazole just to drop his testosterone, got a dose of LHRH agonist in the hospital, and then subsequently was put on bicalutamide on a continuous basis.
And then what happened?
So he ultimately had a nice response, about 20 months or 22 months to ADT, then had a slow rise in PSA and then began to have some fatigue. His bicalutamide was withdrawn. He continued to have more bone pain and fatigue. And then he was treated with docetaxel and prednisone using a conventional schedule. And really after one cycle of docetaxel, his pain was much better and had a nice clinical response. So he got 6 cycles, was feeling much better. Therapy was held. And then about 4 months later, he began to have symptoms, again, bone pain and some fatigue.
Just out of curiosity, a 77-year-old man's got some comorbidities. What do you think the likelihood is that he would have gotten chemotherapy, you know, in general, you know, let's say across this country?
I think it's hit and miss. I think there are a lot of places where somebody would have made a judgment he was too old or too sick to get it.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm wondering about, whether he would get to an oncologist, but anyhow, he got to you. And how did he tolerate the docetaxel at 77?
Phenomenally well. As is typical with docetaxel and prostate cancer, after one cycle, the guy came back feeling much better. I mean, this is, you know, again, one of the things that I, especially when I talk to urologists, but occasionally some of my community oncology colleagues, you know, when we think about giving chemotherapy to advanced epithelial cancer, I would argue that there is no cancer that has a more dramatic clinical benefit to chemotherapy early on than prostate cancer.
Why do I think that maybe not everybody knows that?
Because you're right. But really, it's remarkable. And again, you know, when I'm talking around the country and, you know, I'm talking to a group of oncologists, those who've had that similar experience, you see them nodding their heads. Because when you give a patient a single cycle of therapy and they come back and they're off opioids and their pain is better and they're eating, it's very hard to imagine a more sort of gratifying clinical response.
Just out of curiosity, did you give him growth factors?
I don't typically use growth factor with docetaxel, no.
And he was fine in terms of myelosuppression?
Yeah, he did fine. I mean, his hemoglobin, I'm guessing, was probably in the 9 range to start with. And over the course of a couple of cycles, his hemoglobin improved, as one would expect.
So what was the next step?
Again, so 4 months after he's treated, he's progressing. And because he had had such a good response and a 4-month benefit, I think, is reasonable, he got 3 additional cycles of docetaxel. You know, he had a response, but not as dramatic as his initial 6 cycles. 2 months after that 3rd cycle of retreatment docetaxel, he was again symptomatic. His hemoglobin and white count were holding up. His performance status was still reasonable. And the discussion with him was, you know, what are our options? And among the options that we discussed was treating him with cabazitaxel. And he had, I think, initially some reservations about chemotherapy, but having gone through it and having done so well, was actually very open-minded about additional therapy. So we gave him a dose of cabazitaxel at 20 per meter. We dose modified a bit. And he tolerated therapy very well and, again, had a clinical response and received a total of 4 cycles and when I stopped treating him.
And, again, growth factors?
No, did not use growth factors. I opted to just start him at 20 per meter as opposed to 25, and he actually did fine.
And what do you think that most investigators do in terms of dosing and growth factors, particularly in a 77-year-old?
Well, this is an intriguing story. When cabazitaxel was FDA approved, actually the FDA put in the label the discussion of growth factor use, although that wasn't part of the trial. I think that what I've told people is that, you know, when cabazitaxel was first approved, that first sort of 6 months or 9 months, most of the patients that we were using cabazitaxel on were really very heavily treated. You know, they had multiple docetaxel regimens, maybe mitoxantrone, maybe this, maybe that. And I think that their getting into trouble with white cell issues was much higher than the next generation where cabazitaxel may be used earlier. And I think we don't really know whether 25 and 20 per meter are equivalent. There are trials ongoing that's going to address some of the dosing issues. I tend to be somewhat conservative in use of growth factors and trying to simplify folks' life. I work in an urban academic center, so sometimes if I can dose modify slightly and avoid the use of growth factors, my patients find it more convenient.
So what's his current situation?
This gentleman, after his four cycles, really, I think, no longer was receiving the kind of clinical benefit, and I managed him with supportive care and enlisted hospice, and he died about 6 weeks ago.
When you think back to the time that he was on treatment, particularly those two different courses of chemo, I'm just kind of curious, what do you think it meant to him at a personal level? I mean, you were not able to cure him. You were able to palliate him temporarily. Maybe he lived a little longer. How did that translate into his actual life?
Well, I know that especially during that first six cycles of docetaxel, he unequivocally was much happier. He was much more active. He would talk about some of the things that he was able to do. So to me, the key take home about what he thought was his willingness to receive cabazitaxel. Because this is a guy who sort of lived alone. You know, he was beginning to have symptoms again. He'd already had chemotherapy over the course of a part of a year. But because he felt so well during parts of the chemotherapy, he was open to receiving more therapy with the, you know, we talked about the potential survival benefit, but really his goal was, can I feel better? Can this drug make me feel better so I can do the things I want to do? That was his rationale for being treated.
I'm kind of curious in terms of just in this particular individual, how he tolerated docetaxel compared to cabazitaxel, kind of the same?
Well, you know, in fairness, of course, by the time he got cabazitaxel, he had already had nine cycles of docetaxel. It was 10 or 11 months later. You know, he probably was a bit more fatigued from drug than he would have been from the docetaxel. But in general, because we were able to avoid the need for a hospital stay for neutropenic fever, you know, he didn't really have any significant complications. He didn't get as dramatic a response to cabazitaxel, although he did have a clinical response. So, you know, you're talking about a second-line therapy, and it's invariably going to be more difficult to give a second-line therapy than using it up front.
So still, we have in this one individual the interesting situation of having disease progression on docetaxel, responding to cabazitaxel. Of course, that's what was seen in the trial in a lot of patients. But what oncologists say is, well, if it's roughly as well tolerated, sounds like maybe somehow it has some advantage, why shouldn't we use it first, assuming we could get it paid for?
And it's a great question. And as you know, there's a large trial that's basically being done to address this question. It makes good sense to me to do the trial. You know, my own practice is when I can force myself is to try to figure out that I know the answer before we do the study. So I tend to not use it frontline outside the context of a trial.
Anything new and exciting in terms of chemotherapy for prostate cancer, including with these two agents? You know, there have been efforts to look at PSA-only disease. There have been efforts to combine it with other things. Anything out there that looks encouraging?
Well, you know, in fairness, one of the stories that I tell about docetaxel is a really active drug in prostate cancer. And the way we, besides the fact that we know that it's active, the way we know it is that if you look at the litany of trials that have done docetaxel with or without something else, every one of them to date has fallen short. And it's not necessarily because the experimental agent in question doesn't work. It's because it's hard to overcome a really active drug. So there are other trials in the pipeline that are addressing plus minus docetaxel, and we'll wait to see. But to be honest with you, I think that the larger question with these two agents is now as more molecules come online, where do we use chemotherapy? So there are trials out there. There's the U.S. intergroup trial of ADT with or without docetaxel. That trial is accruing very nicely. It'll probably finish accruing in the next 12 to 18 months, and we're going to have an early chemotherapy trial. There are other early chemotherapy trials, none of which to date have demonstrated the kind of outcomes that would generate a change in practice.
Well, one practical issue is the patient who's, I'd call them endocrine refractory rather than castrate resistant, but, you know, whatever, who still has biochemical-only disease.
So, you know, to me, in the context of a patient who is truly refractory, so just thinking ahead a couple of years, what that might entail is a patient who has had LHRH agonist therapy, has developed disease progression on an androgen biosynthesis inhibitor, maybe even progression after a second generation anti-androgen. That patient is not the kind of patients that we see today. The integration of chemotherapy into PSA-only disease, I mean, again, at the end of the day, both docetaxel and cabazitaxel improve survival. One of the great questions that still remains is the absolute appropriate timing of initial cytotoxic chemotherapy. I tend to treat patients in a non-study setting only when they have minimal symptoms. I don't treat asymptomatic patients because I'm not convinced that there is enough benefit accrues to the patient to even move that toxicity up earlier. And now that we have a series of new compounds that are targeting the AR, I think chemotherapy is still going to be widely used, but at specific disease points, as opposed to just moving it up earlier because we don't really have anything else to do.
What about alpha-radin? What is it and would be a consideration in, you know, a patient like this, or could it have been?
Yeah, alpha-radin is an interesting comment. It's an alpha emitter. The press release was from the first interim analysis of a post-docetaxel randomized trial. So there's no public information beyond that other than an interim analysis reports a survival benefit. This is going to be an interesting compound. It appears to have a very excellent toxicity profile. So again, I've not seen any other data other than the phase two data that's in the public domain. But clearly, if once this data is presented and then ultimately makes its way to the regulatory authorities, you know, this may represent yet another post-docetaxel therapy that has the potential to improve survival. And again, based on the limited data that we've seen so far, seems to have a very nice safety profile.
How about your last patient?
So this gentleman was probably about 72 now. So when he had a radical prostatectomy, he was about 64, high-grade tumor, had a Gleason 9 tumor. Did well for a while, probably got salvage radiotherapy early on, but over the course of 8 years, had PSA progression, shortening PSA doubling time, was asymptomatic, but because of the doubling time, had a bone scan, which showed small volume bone metastases. So he presents now, feeling fine, but now has a bone scan that unequivocally is abnormal. This gentleman, pretty smart guy, knows that there are lots of things out there, is very active, does a lot of traveling, very much interested in maintaining his quality of life. So he's been on ADT for a time. He's now got progression. And the issue for him is with low volume bone mets, which are new on ADT, PSA progression as well, what does he want to do? And quality of life for him is important. So discussions of cipulucil T, he thought was interesting, but not now. Too busy. Not interested in going on a clinical trial because he travels too much. Was interested in doing reasonable things. So one of the things that we talked to him about was, again, we went through the same litany of discussion about abiraterone and its lack of availability in this clinical setting for at least now, other than an off-label prescription. So we talked to him about using a bone-targeted agent, and we talked a little bit about both denosumab as well as alendronic acid, and then perhaps an oral secondary hormonal maneuver. So opted to start ketoconazole and zoledronic acid.
So let's just say he's very well off financially, turns around and says to you, you know, just tell me what you think's best. I'll buy it if we can't get it reimbursed.
So we actually had that discussion, and he didn't blink too much when I told him how much the abiraterone monthly cost is. And he said, is it possible that if I respond to ketoconazole and then subsequently progress, whenever Abby is available, am I likely to respond? And I said, well, we do have data that there are patients treated with keto who ultimately respond to Abby. So he said, fine, let's go.
And what did you decide to do in terms of bone-targeted therapy?
We talked about both denosumab and zoledronic acid. And he's an interesting gentleman. He's an economist. And for whatever reason, you know, he would ask about the costs of all of these compounds. And I told him, you know, one is a different compound. It's new. One is about to become a generic compound. We talked a little bit about the differences in terms of the data, and he thought the safety profile sounded pretty similar and said to me, why don't we just start with plan A, zoledronic acid, and that at some point in time, you know, we talked a little bit about using even things like N-telopeptide to see whether or not he would come down in zoledronic acid, and then upon progression to switch to denosumab. He said, look, let's go with the tried and true, and let's have zoledronic acid, and we put him on ketoconazole at 400 TID with a little bit of hydrocortisone replacement, and he's been on therapy now for about 8 months. He actually had a biochemical response to keto. He has a little bit of fluid retention as a consequence, but really nothing that impacts on his quality of life, and he's tolerated the zoledronic acid so far well. We gave him a little bit of a break because he wanted to get some dental work done, so we gave him about a three-month hiatus and restarted it.
And I'm just kind of curious, though, in terms of, you know, what you say to patients. I'm sure the subject of osteonecrosis of the jaw came up. I'm curious what kind of numbers you give to patients for both of these bone-targeted treatments and what kind of numbers you give them in terms of efficacy, in terms of bone events.
Well, in terms of osteonecrosis, you know, we try to reinforce that it's a very rare event and that it's probably, in the big scheme of things, avoidable if we just all do our jobs. It's in the 1% or less range. It's a very rare event. We just drill into patients that the first thing you do is you call your dentist's office and you get that into the record, and you don't go to the dentist before you talk to us, and you talk to both the doc and the dentist, and nothing happens until there's sign off on both. So we minimize the sort of iatrogenic issues. And my sense clinically is that if you do that, the issue is really a non-issue.
So what about efficacy?
Well, you know, efficacy is hard to define on an individual basis, right? So we have to rely on randomized trials to say that in populations, there appears to be enough activity to sort of swing the dial. But when you say, hey, doc, how likely is this going to work in me? That's a hard thing to do. I don't know that we have a good way to answer that.
How about if I say, well, whatever it is, in terms of your risk of having a fracture or needing radiation therapy because of severe pain, et cetera, it's going to be about 20% relatively less if you take denosumab.
Those are reasonable. And again, that's a population answer. And I think that gives somebody a sense of the level of activity of the compound. And that's sort of how we have to present the information to patients.
Do you see that? I mean, you know, getting into this thing of relative versus absolute risk and stuff like that. But I mean, do you see that as a tangibly positive benefit in and of itself? Sounds like maybe not.
It's a really good question. And I will tell you that my own bias in terms of how I manage patients tends to be, I probably use less of these classes of agents in my patient management than some colleagues do. Is that because I don't value the protection in terms of skeletal related events? No. I do think that going forward, we have to be more discriminating in terms of trying to sort of risk adjust. So for example, I wouldn't use a bone-targeted agent like this in a patient with nodal metastatic disease who doesn't have obvious bone mets. I mean, you could argue, I think, either way, but I don't tend to do that. And I think that for patients who have stable, low-volume bone mets for long periods of time, whose natural history is a little bit more benign, I mean, again, we're talking about a monthly therapy that has its own issues and costs. So I think ultimately we're going to, as we have these new generations of drugs that we've been talking about for the last bit, as they come online and they're all incredibly expensive, I think we're going to have to come up with a strategy to try to individualize therapy to look at patients at higher risk for SREs and be able to subset them out and say, we really need to be aggressive with you. And some other patients, perhaps we can be a little less aggressive with these agents.
As long as we're talking about bone-targeted therapy, maybe just to finish out here, what are your thoughts about bone-targeted therapy in the patient who's getting androgen deprivation, period? You know, not with metastatic disease, but for PSA-only disease.
Well, I guess my first take on that is I tend to not treat patients with PSA-only disease with ADT because I really think that gets us into the conundrum. And one of the things that I've always...
Not with a fast doubling time?
Well, I mean, again, if you're arguing about somebody with a less than 3 month PSA doubling time and starting ADT, I'm okay with that. But I think the vast majority of patients historically have gotten treated don't fall into that category.
Are you saying that in general, in the community, people are more usually treated for the first time with metastatic disease?
No, I think in the community, it happens just the way you describe. I'm suggesting that in my judgment, that's not perhaps the best way to manage patients.
That's interesting. But are you saying that then in your general practice, more likely you're going to be starting it when they have mets?
or very short PSA doubling times. Yeah, that's correct. We don't routinely treat ADT in PSA-only disease. There really isn't any evidence to support its use. And here's the conundrum. You know, following PSA introduction in the late 80s and then a rapid shift in the U.S. community in terms of very early use of ADT, what happened was, of course, we began to identify the ADT-related bone toxicity issues, which then generated studies to try to prevent these issues. And my point is, did we create a whole series of trials to prevent a problem that we shouldn't have created in the first place? I mean, why are we treating PSA-only disease with ADT in huge numbers, in contradistinction to the rest of the world?